The text, again, is Micah chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. The title is Turning Defeat into Victory. Turning Defeat into Victory. Two major points will be at the top of the page. You can put Israel's Doom, verse 1, chapter 5, verse 1. And then about halfway down the page, you might want to write Israel's Hope, verses 2 through 6. And then there'll be a couple other subpoints in there, and we'll get to those as we get there. But first of all, turn to the text. First, let me read the entire text, and then we'll go back over it. Now muster yourselves, troops, daughters of troops. They have laid siege against us. With a rod they will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek. But as for you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah. From you one will go forth to me to be ruler in Israel. His going forth are from long ago, the days of eternity. Therefore he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel. And he will arise and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will remain, because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth. This one will be our peace. When the Assyrian invades the land, when he tramples on our citadels, then we will rise against him. Seven shepherds and eight leaders of men. They will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, the land of Nimrod at its entrances, and he will deliver us from the Assyrians when he attacks our land and when he tramples our territory. In 701 BC, the word of the Lord came to Micah of Marshith. And it was in the days of Hezekiah, here in chapter 5, that king of Judah was reigning over Israel in Jerusalem. And this prophecy came to Micah while he was in Jerusalem. Again, verse 1 of chapter 5. He says, now muster yourselves in troops, daughter of troops. They have laid siege against us. With a rod they will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek. Judah, at this present time, has been overrun in its capital. Jerusalem is surrounded, under siege, by Assyrian troops. The situation is utterly hopeless, a situation which was prophesied by Isaiah some 30 years earlier in Isaiah chapter 7, 8 to 10. It's described there as Assyria coming like a flood, and they will be inundated up to their necks, up to here, with Assyrians, about to be drowned with their presence. King Hezekiah has been caged like a bird. The warrior king, Sennacherib, describes the situation from his perspective. In actual writings that archaeologists discovered in Nineveh in the 1800s, once they rediscovered the city of Nineveh, which had been laid hidden for years, about 1824, a British explorer, discovered the ancient city of Nineveh. And actually, you can go online and you can actually see photographs of some of the excavation. They have some restorations that they've done there. But they discovered the tablets, and unwritten on those tablets, they found the king Sennacherib had written this about the siege on Jerusalem. He says, as for Hezekiah the Judean, who did not submit to my yoke, 46 of his strong-walled cities, as well as the small cities in the neighborhood, which were without number, by escalade and by bringing up siege engines, by attacking and storming on foot, by mines, tunnels, and breaches, I besieged and took. Himself like a cage bird I shut up, that is Hezekiah, in Jerusalem, his royal city. Thus we have Israel's doom. Now, Israel's doom not just Jerusalem's doom, because this is all culminating in the entire nation as a whole. Jerusalem is the last stand at this point in 701. Israel, the northern kingdom, has already been defeated. All of the Judean cities have now been defeated, even the stronghold Lachish. And Jerusalem is the last stand. Israel is down to its last ticking time bomb. Kind of like a Hollywood movie. We're counting down 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and then something happens. Right? The last second. We find here in chapter 5, verse 1, Micah is not actually attempting to tell Jerusalem, that is, lady under attack, or this is a different translation, but he's not trying to tell Jerusalem as you see it in your translation. I went through all the different translations, New American Standard, King James, NIV, Revised Standard, and they all made a reference to troops. It gives you the impression that the prophet or the writer is attempting to tell the Jerusalem residents to muster your troops. Just get ready. Prepare for the attack. The idea of troops, what do troops do? Well, they attack. They invade. But Micah here is describing their frantic circumstances. The Hebrew word gadad, troops, allows for this meaning. So a better translation is the one I found from the one I'm using, the main commentary, the New International Commentary on this Micah by Leslie C. Allen. He translated it this way, though I couldn't discover or understand where he got this translation. I don't know what translation this is, but I think it gives us a better understanding of what the actual text means in Hebrew. He says, now you are gashing yourselves, attacking yourselves, and there's a, in other words, lady under attack. Siege is laid against you with the stick. They are striking on the cheek Israel's judge. The meaning of this is the inhabitants of Jerusalem are so dependent or despondent, they are like an insane person who bangs his head against the wall. He's like, I can't believe what's going on. It's like I got this pain over here in my right left arm, so I'm going to strike my right arm to divert the pain over from this. That's how chaotic it was, how despondent they were. They were just, they didn't know what to do. They're surrounded. They're about to die. They know it. What are they going to do? So those laying siege are described as striking the judge, that is the king, on the cheek, which is would be an act of humiliation. Micah is using a play on words. We don't see it here in English, but he is using similar sounding Hebrew words to express the reversal of roles. A judge in Hebrew is called shafat. And a shafat is one who strikes others, judges others, with a shabet. Shabbat, shabet, right? Or a rod, a stick. And the root word meaning a branch. Of course, you get a stick and a rod from a tree branch. Right? So the meaning here is the judge, a judge, strikes others with judgment. But here it is the judge who is the one being struck. That is, he is being judged. And God says in Isaiah 10:5 that he's going to use Assyria as a rod or stick of his anger to bring judgment upon the nation of Israel. So God's wrath is at work, reprisal for the sins of leaders and people, an implicit warning that the path of disobedience leads to disaster for Jerusalem and Judea. And later in Micah 5, chapter 15, he says, I will execute vengeance and anger and wrath on the nations which have not obeyed. And he's going to start with his own nation of Israel. But how did Israel and Jerusalem, Judea, get into this situation? Are they not God's people? Did not God promise them to bless them and protect them from their enemies? Well, we have to go back and do a little review. I did a series, if you remember, on Isaiah chapters 7 and 8 and chapter 9 and chapter 11. Actually, this message is kind of picking up where I left off in chapter 8. If you remember, there were three kings prior to Hezekiah. There was Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz. Uzziah and Jotham were both good kings, it says. Ahaz, bad king. Both Uzziah and Jotham, it says in the Word, did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but they did not remove the high places, and the people continued to act corruptly. And King Ahaz also says that he made molten images and burned his sons in fire, human sacrifice. He sacrificed at the high places himself in every city of Judah and provoked the Lord to anger. Also, and we find throughout Micah, he lists some of these other rebellions among the people, that there was perversion of true religion. There were sacrifices on high places. Now, these sacrifices in the high places weren't necessarily places where they would offer sacrifices to other gods. They were actually altars that they would built up close by to maybe where they lived, so they wouldn't have to travel all the way to Jerusalem. They could go more convenient, and they could offer sacrifices to Yahweh, the Lord, their God, but in their own way and their own convenience. That's what there was the perversion of true religion. People don't do that today, right? There were also false prophets that led people astray. There were prophets and priests who used religion to make money. Of course, that never happens today either, right? Today, all of these things happen today, actually. There were sorcerers, fortune-telling, craven images, and sacred sites pervaded the land. And then in Ahaz's day, he even closed the temple, closed the doors. When Wesley came in this morning, we came in, and we didn't unlock the door out there, and Wesley's out there banging on the door, "Let me in!" So the church was closed, but we opened it. So in Ahaz's day, all these things were going on. This is how they had gotten to this point. Now, remember, God had told them back in Numbers chapter 33, verses 51 and 52, that when you cross over to into Jordan, in the land of Canaan, then you will drive out all the inhabitants of the land, which didn't happen, from before you, and destroy all the figured stones, and destroy all the molten images, and demolish all of the high places. That's what they were told to do. Of course, none of that ever happened completely. They did some, but not completely. And because of that, God promised that if they didn't do what he had commanded, he says, "I will strike you 7 times for your sins. I will also bring upon you a sword which will execute vengeance for the covenant. If you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me, I will act with wrathful hostility against you, and I will punish you. I will destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and heap your remains on the remains of your idols, for the soul shall abhor you. I will lay waste your cities," as is quoted here on the screen, "as well as I will make your sanctuaries desolate. I will make the land desolate so that your enemies will settle in it and will be appalled by it. You, however, I will scatter among the nations and will draw out the sword after you. As your land becomes desolate, your cities will become a waste." So that's God's promises. And he brought that back all to fulfillment through a series of invasions. The first invasion began in 735 BC with the Syro-Ephraimite War. The Syrians, the capital of Damascus, got together with the Ephraimites, the northern kingdom, and they came down to Judah and said, we're going to depose you and overthrow you. Ahaz, you know, says in Isaiah, he shook like a leaf. And he then sent off messengers to the Syrian kings to come and help him. But as a result of that war, 120,000 Judeans were killed in one day, 200,000 were taken captive, though later returned, and much spoil was said was taken. At the same time, the Philistines and the Edomites took advantage of the situation, also taking many captives and stripping their defenses. Then, in 732 B.C., Tiglath-Pileser III invaded the land. This is, again, referenced to in Isaiah chapters 7, verse 3 through 8:10. He's called the Assyrian Napoleon. He invaded northern Israel and captured parts of the land and then set Hosea on the throne over the king of the northern kingdom. This was shortly after the fall. He already defeated Damascus. The Assyrians kings were actually warlords. Assyria was built for war. Their cities, their nation, it was a nation of warriors. Their rulers were warrior kings. If you were to go out and ask the average Assyrian, well, what do you do for a living? What is your occupation? They say, well, I'm a soldier and I'm a plunderer. Much like the Vikings. All right, they just they didn't waste time going out and planting the crops, taking care of their cows and stuff. Well, we'll just go to our neighbors and we'll just take theirs. That's basically what essentially what they did. They were built for that. And this is what they were doing here. In 722 B.C., Shalmaneser and Sargon II invaded and in 722 destroyed the northern kingdom completely. After Tiglath-Pileser died, Hosea took occasion to cease paying tribute to Assyria. The northern king, Hosea, turned to Egypt for help. As a result, Shalmaneser moved at once and began to seize Samaria, which lasted about 3 years, and then Samaria fell in 722 B.C., and the people of Israel were taken captive. About the same time, though, Shalmaneser died, and then Sargon II completed the takeover and Israel's capital and deported, like I said, the northern kingdom. 2 Kings 17:18-20 says this concerning that. So the Lord was angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. None was left except the tribe of Judah. Also Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the customs which Israel had introduced. The Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel and afflicted them and gave them into the hand of the plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. And at the same time, King Ahaz of Judah paid a heavy tribute to Assyria to assist him. Ahaz had to present to his master, which he had given to Assyria, treasures out of the temple, his palace, and the houses of the prince. Now we come to this present situation that Micah is referring to in chapter 5, verse 1. We have the king Sennacherib, who was king of Assyria from 705 to 681. He invades Judah and came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Hezekiah sent to Sennacherib at Lachish, who he was presently sieging that city. He sends them apologies and payments of silver and gold as tribute, begging him to retreat. However, Sennacherib says, okay, I'll send my army to you. So he sends a large army from Lachish, who they were finishing up their siege there, sends his army to Jerusalem. Thus, we have Lady under attack. However, the Lord is about to defeat or turn defeat into victory. We're down to 1 second. Doom, we have Israel's doom. Now, I might want to mention at this point that we see in this, in the Old Testament, in a lot of the prophets, a mixture of hope and doom. We have many times a long doom section followed by a short hope section, or a short doom followed by a long doom. Look at the, I got this from the chart from the book. This is the kind of like the outline of the book of Micah. And you see here in chapters 1, 2 through 2:11, we have a long section about describing their doom. And then chapter 2 and 2 verses, we have a short hope. And then same repetition in chapters 3 and then 4, long doom, short hope. Then a mixture of the two. And then in chapters 3 through 5, we have long distress, short hope, short distress, long hope. And then the present text, we have short doom or distress with long hope, and et cetera, et cetera. Long hope, short hope. And then the last two chapters, we have a long doom, again, followed by a short section of hope. All right. Martin Luther commented about the prophets, saying this, his impression about the prophetic books. He says, they have a queer way, that is the prophets, of talking, like people who, instead of proceeding in an orderly manner, ramble off from one thing to the next so that you cannot make heed of tale of them or see what they are getting at. So Micah is, kind of, again, a blatant example of this seeming jumble, so that you search through the literary structure at first to find sight of an impossible task of what is the structure of this book. So it's not like the Gospels where you have like a strict almost a chronological order of things, that one thing after another, you know, and this happened and then this happened and then this happened. But in the prophets, if you go back to the chart, you have, if you almost look, if you were going to do it chronologically, you'd put this section and then read this section, the dooms, put all the dooms together, and then put all the hopes together, and then you'd have a, you know, kind of understand. Because so he talks about something here, and then he's going to elaborate and give you more information here, and then and so on. So that's how you kind of have to understand many of these Old Testament books. Also, there's an understanding that there's a short-term deliverance. Hezekiah is going to be delivered by the angel of the Lord. Sennacherib, we find this in the account of 2 Kings chapter 18 and 19, also in 2 Chronicles chapter 32, and in Isaiah chapters 36 and 37. They're almost parallel or almost identical to each other. And we find that Sennacherib, he comes and he boasts about his own superiority and taunts Hezekiah and the Lord into giving up, for one cannot stop him now. I have come and I have defeated all these other countries. I have defeated all these other gods. They've all made sacrifices to their gods. They called out to their gods for salvation, and none of their gods helped them. And you're next. But at the time, God had other plans of delivering Jerusalem from destruction. And he does this by killing 185,000 Assyrians in one night. They all just drop dead. And Sennacherib is then forced to retreat. And then sometime later, actually it's about 12 years later, he is killed by his own two sons in the temple, so to speak, in the sight of his own gods. His own gods bearing witness, the statues, to his death. So the nations have gathered around Jerusalem, and 7:1, are already doomed. They have walked into a trap. Arrayed against God's people and so against God, they have played into the hands of the master strategist who is in control of the situation and will turn defeat into victory. Why? Because according to Micah 4:12, it says, they do not know the thoughts of the Lord, and they do not understand his purposes, for he has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. Now, Micah isn't just talking about their present circumstance and giving them hope. He's giving them hope for the future. Micah goes past the present circumstances and prophesies concerning Israel's ultimate deliverance. The things, he says in chapter 4, verse 1, the things that will come about in the last days. So we come, you've seen this illustration before where Hezekiah, or many of the Old Testament prophets, make a prophecy. And from their perspective, they only see the fulfillment of one at one time. They don't see the gaps that occur between the two. So throughout the Old Testament, you see prophecies concerning the future. Some of those prophecies will be fulfilled shortly, some midterm, and some long term. So some of these prophecies we're going to look at have dual fulfillments, or the time when they were fulfilled will be... So from the Old Testament perspective, that's how we have to understand this. So we come to Israel's hope, verses 2 through 6. First, we have hope from the past. Chapter 5, verse 2. But as for you, Bethlehem, Ephrathitha, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. Hope for the future begins in the distant past. 300 years earlier, a future king emerged from a little town in Bethlehem, meaning house of bread. That's what Bethlehem means, a house of bread. Ephrathitha means fruitfulness. It also goes back to the stories of Boaz and Ruth, who were wheat farmers. David was a shepherd. This was a community of farmers and shepherds. Out of this was going to become a great warrior. Not the typical place where you're going to find someone who's designed to become a great warrior king. This warrior king is going to emerge and defeat the great armies surrounding Jerusalem. You know, no one expected little old David to go and defeat Goliath. David was a shepherd. All he had was a slingshot. He was a boy. Goliath was a grown man, a huge grown man. All right? Contrast. But this a warrior is going to become a ruler, a sovereign of no rival. In addition, he's going to come from eternity past. His going forths are from long ago, from the days of eternity. His origin is of eternity past, similar to what Daniel says in 7:13 that he is from the Ancient of Days. Of course, this is obviously a hint to his divinity. I don't know if you know that, or think about this, but only David, of all the kings of Judah, only David and Jesus were actually born in Bethlehem. Where was everyone else born? Solomon and his son Jeroboam, all of the other, they were all born in either Jerusalem, or then afterwards they were born in dispersion in Babylon, or in other parts they came back. Where was Joseph? Where was Joseph's father? Jesus' grandfather, where were they born? Well, they weren't born in Bethlehem. They were all living up in the northern part of Israel, in Nazareth. All right? So this reference back to Bethlehem is taking us back. All right? It's a reminder that God keeps His promises. It reminds them of the Davidic covenant. God will keep His promise. I promise that David's dynasty will not cease from the earth. He will last forever. So all these attempts to destroy David's dynasty, the surrounding army is not going to overcome them. Though even during Jesus' day, the kingly line had faded into obscurity, it will once again rise again and establish anew in its pristine beauty. So we have hope from the past. Now we have hope for the future in chapter 5, 3 through 6. We have first, under hope of restoration, future, hope of restoration, chapter 5, verse 3. It says, therefore, he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel. All hope hangs on the birth of a royal prince. When she who is born, who is in labor, has borne a child, then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel. So all hopes, or the expectation, is doubtless to be related to Isaiah's mysterious promise of Emmanuel's birth, pronounced 30 years ago by Isaiah in chapter 7, verse 14. The problem with the hope of restoration is the present circumstances. Who is present around Jerusalem? Well, they're enemies. And who's absent? The brothers. Where are they? Well, they're off, scattered all over the place. So that presents a problem. But here is the promise that one day the enemies will be defeated and his brothers will be once again reunited, restored and returned under a righteous king. Then we have the promise of a hope. I'd first put hope of the shepherd, but I think it's hope in the shepherd. Chapter 5, verse 4. It says, he will arise and shepherd his flock, this ruler, in the strength of the Lord and in the majesty of his name, the Lord his God, and they will remain, because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth. He will rule like a shepherd, for the shepherd cares for and protects his sheep. This is also an allusion to David in the dress of the founder. Now we know from the New Testament that, what, Jesus is called the Good Shepherd, John chapter 10, verse 11. He's also the chief shepherd, First Peter 5, 4. I'll go back if you want to write that down. The Good Shepherd. John chapter 10, verse 11. Then the chief shepherd, 1 Peter 5, 4. And he's also called the great shepherd in Hebrews 13, verse 20. Also we find in Revelation 7, 17, it says, for the Lamb is in the center of the throne, will be their shepherd. Referring basically in that present context, the tribulation saints. And they will guide them to springs of water of life, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. The shepherd will be said to be empowered with the Lord's strength and authority, strength and name. The God-given power of the coming shepherd king is the basis of the security of his sheep. The Lord promised that they will live in their own place and not be disturbed again, nor will they will afflicted the wicked afflict them any more as it did in the past. That's according to 2 Samuel 7, verse 10. That's part of the Davidic covenant. And also it says that his name will be known throughout the world. It will be a universal kingdom. Find in Luke chapter 1, verses 30 through 33, when the angel came to Mary, and the angel said to her,
Don't be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall name him Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom will have no end. So again, a reiteration of the promise that's stated in Micah. Now, how does peace come about? We have the promise of the hope of peace and victory over the enemy in verses 5 and 6. It says, "This one will be our peace. When the Assyrian invades our land, when he tramples on our citadels," or our castles and fortresses, "then he will rise against him," that is Assyrian, in Assyria, "with 7 shepherds and 8 leaders of men." So the one born in Bethlehem, this child will go forth to be a ruler over a restored and united Israel, to shepherd his people in the strength and authority of the Lord, to be great in all the earth. This one will bring peace and deliverance over their enemy. But the question is, when does this happen? Well, it says it will happen when the Assyrian, it's very definite here, when the Assyrian invades the land. Now, it's not referring to the present situation, because if it was the present situation, he would not have described it with the word when, but he would have said now, or he's saying that the Assyrian is in the land, not when he comes. He's already there. If he's referring to the Sennacherib as being the Assyrian, it's not referring to Sennacherib, because he's referring, again, this is about the last days. In the last days, an Assyrian, and we don't know who the Assyrian is, other than we think it may be also what's known in Daniel as the King of the North, and also could refer to the beast and the Antichrist. He's the one with the 666, right? Nobody knows his name. Nobody's going to know his name until the time when he is revealed, when he rises to power. Then the Assyrian, the King of the North, the beast, and the Antichrist, people will know his name. And then, I looked at one of the other Psalms, one of the other messages I have, it said there that when he is destroyed and he takes them and he throws them into the lake of fire, his name will be forgotten. Nobody knows his name now, and then afterwards, no one will ever remember what his name was. So only people at the time will know his name. So we can't figure out 666, that's Ronald Wilson Reagan, or, you know, try to figure out his name using the number 666. That ain't going to work, because no one's going to know his name again until that happens. But when does peace come? Peace comes when, in the future, the Assyrian invades the land in the last days. In Daniel 11:45, it says, "He will pitch his tent of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to an end, and no one will help him." In Micah, back in Micah 5:6, we see this, that when he comes into the land with the sword, the land of Nimrod, and he will deliver us from the Assyrian when he attacks our land, when he tramples the territory. Isaiah 14:24-25 says, "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely just as I have intended, so it will happen, and just as I have planned it, so it will stand, to break the Assyrian in my land, and I will trample him on my mountain." Now notice that when this happens, it's when the Assyrian sets foot in the Judean territory, he himself will be driven back so vigorously of a counterattack that his own country then is going to be invaded. Here we have a total reverse of what the present circumstance is. Down to 1 second, and they're about to be destroyed. And God, the king, comes to save Israel. And he's not only going to destroy his enemies there in Jerusalem, but he's going to go take his army and sweep into their own lands and destroy their cities and so forth. So the Assyrian, says, is driven back by seven shepherds and eight leaders of men with the sword. You know, a shepherd doesn't carry a sword. Maybe David did, I guess. But he usually carried, a stick to shepherd use it to direct the sheep and also maybe to drive back wolves and stuff. But here we have a shepherd who have swords. Of course, use swords to slash and kill. A nation that was once leaderless finds men to take charge and to turn a defeat into a routing victory. All right, in closing, we see God's people saved, delivered. I think we have John calling me. We'll have to do it later. All right. In Ahaz's day, Assyria withdrew from Judah and marched to Babylon after hearing a disturbance in the land. A remnant remained in the house of David was saved. In Hezekiah's day, 185,000 troops were killed by the angel of the Lord, and Sennacherib withdrew to Nineveh and was killed by his own sons. In Jesus' day, the Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem and Judea and made slaves out of the remaining inhabitants. A remnant remained, and they were dispersed around the world. In our day, many Jews have returned and live in Judea, but they don't live securely. They are in constant threat of invasion. In the end times, the king of the north, known as the Assyrian, will invade Israel, and a child born in Bethlehem will deliver Israel from the Assyrian. When he comes, he's going to find the Assyrian in the land during the tribulation period. But at that time, all Israel will be saved. Close with a quote from Allen, who says, "Judah and Jerusalem has been brought to the brink of total despair. They are convinced of their weakness and lack of resources. There is no king, no leader who can save them. To a people who have promise of a king to come and who will be God's own answer to the problem of Assyria, now that the people's self-confident hopes have been proved ill-founded, a Davidic prince, he will be the embodiment of the theocratic power and peace, and his coming will spell the creation of a new united Israel." So Israel's doom is turned to hope, defeat into victory.